welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Jim Boyer, and he will be speaking on Practice of Relationship Vitality. So let's listen in on Jim Boyer.
We've been doing some sessions on the soul and close relationships as a general theme. Our first talk, we were looking at the two different kinds of spirituality. Spirituality of the edge, which is roughly defined as spirituality that has to do with the individual quest for connection with God and inspiration in one's life, and often might lead to things we might describe as prophetic and tremendous kinds of efforts to realize our calling or our sense of connection with God in our life. And contrasting that with what we might call spirituality at the center, which is characterized in Ernest Boyer's book, Finding God at Home, as a spirituality that has to do with disciplines of everyday life, particularly the discipline of caring for one another and the discipline of the routine and how we can see the sacred at work in that aspect of life. And when we talk about a close relationship over time, we're very much dealing with the dynamics of a numbing effect on our conscious mind that leads to such things as taking a partner or a close friend for granted, assuming we know them, you know, better than we really do, doing all sorts of mental shortcuts and spiritual shortcuts in our relationship and in our life because it's easier that way, and we're sort of lazy, and it's more difficult to stay open to the unfolding spiritual soul side of an ongoing relationship. And that's what we're going to focus on today, is some of those attitudes and some of the behaviors and patterns that can support the ongoing vitality of a close relationship that is the subject of many different programs and attempts to revitalize and nurture close relationships. In my pastoral counseling practice, in which I see mainly couples, I talk about it as nurturing the marital plant. And we talk a lot about the image of, or the relationship plant, the image of brown or green or in between colored leaves, and getting enough nurture and enough fertilizer on the plant to keep it vital and flowing. What we have on the board to start with is a particular map that I think is very useful. That ties into our discussion last time we got together yesterday around what we had talked about in terms of soul-friendly versus soul-unfriendly kinds of attitudes and behaviors. And this is another way to kind of extend that and bridge over to a general focus on how do we understand, how do we talk about those attitudes and behaviors that might be vitalizing and maintaining vitality in a close relationship. This particular map I like because your goal is real clear, if you all can read it. It says with you is the middle preposition or adverb or adjective, whatever that is. It's the really, I think, a real short way to conceptualize the business of connecting with another self in a equal, non-power, non-coercive kind of a way that seeks to connect with the other person, encounter the other person, to share yourself and to receive the experience of the other person. The business of being with the other person, so with you. Versus, as we see, all the other alternatives, which could be a little less, as we're using the phrase, soul enriching or soul inviting. And just to go around these, of course, the obvious would be over you, and that would be in some kind of hierarchical or parental kind of position. At 1:30 here, we have in you, which has to do with relating in a way that is where the self is related to the person where there's not a real encounter between selves. There's kind of an absorption there. Here before you at 3 o'clock, that gets to the whole business of again having one's life defined in an over-dedicated sort of a way, so that there's a smothering sort of a relationship. Off of you, this has been made famous by children who may stay too long in a family or something like that, or have a hard time emancipating. Actually, these days, the whole emancipation process is really quite difficult. So we have more of an extended emancipation time, but the dynamic of living off of someone is important to be aware of. And then, of course, under you would be the classic submissive position, where a given individual defines themselves as someone else's servant or someone else's extension, really, of that person, so they're under and disappear into the other person. Without you, we've got denial of connection or dependency and living pretty much in isolation, withdrawal. Against you would be the technical teenage position or adolescent position, called also counter-dependent. That is, anything mom and dad says, this is going to go opposite. But if it's in a peer relationship, say with close friends or husband and wife, then we've got we might call it a gruesome twosome setup, where there's a lot of conflict, a lot of fighting going on here. There's an againstness feel to the relationship. And then up here at 10:30, let's say, we have one in spite of you, which just twists the dynamic and flavor a little more to a maybe War of the Roses kind of a feel to it, where it gets really, really intense. So those are just some of the orientations. We got a lot more room for sin there than we got for grace and for positive relationship. But I think it helps us kind of conceptualize, or maybe it helps anyway, how much slippage there is in this business of both initiating a close relationship on the basis of mutual and encounter and equality, and then, of course, sustaining it over time. And, of course, with all of this, we need the support, inspiration of the Holy Spirit, who keeps calling and inspiring us in a direction such as that. And why do we identify this as somewhat of a goal or somewhat of a guide? Is because I think it does reflect also God's relating to us, certainly as our Creator, we're the created, but He's always relating in a wooing, in a not in a totally equal sort of a way, but certainly in a with you kind of a way. And in fact, much of the themes some of the literature now is around the theme of co-creating with God. That is, we are God's partners in making a better world, making better relationships, that kind of idea. And so we can see that also as a reflection of the way God relates to us. So, but if that's then where we're called and oriented towards, then that opens up, okay, how does this happen? How do we sustain this? And one of the best resources I'm aware of and refer a lot of couples to is a book called Getting the Love You Want. It's one of the most embarrassingly obvious self-help titles I've ever seen, but when you sort through this stuff, you start to find some things that are really pretty rich and pretty non-reductionistic, non-simplistic, and quite useful. I like it both for its background material and overall view of close relationships, including attraction and the natural disillusionment process and whatnot, as well as it's got one of the best sets of exercises that I've seen in any particular single volume. Nice. And so,
yeah. The author's last name?
The author is Harvald Hendrix, a name that's hard to forget, Harvald. And he's also a pastoral counselor, by the way. I like to throw that in. Haven't seen him in any national meetings, but he's over in, based in Dallas. It says his institute is based in Dallas and New York City. I'm not sure exactly where he is. How many have seen this book or looked at it, worked with it? Is it pretty new to people? Okay, so I'll try to give you as much background to understand his stuff as possible. His basic thesis here is that we are attracted to a person not just because they're opposite or interesting, that sort of thing, but he suggests that at an unconscious level again, and of course that's the level of soul that we're talking about, which makes it so hard to define and get a hold of, because it's our conscious mind just operates on a different level there. But he suggests the deep mystery of mate selection or close friendship connection selection has to do with being attracted and drawn towards people who embody both the positive and the negative traits of our primary caregivers, which usually is our parents, when we might feel closest to. Now, this is an idea that is not just radically new or anything like that, but I think the new twist there, and it gets pretty Freudian pretty quick, is that the positive traits, sure, we would be pretty oriented towards someone who loved us the way we were used to being loved, or nurtured in a way that we were used to being nurtured. The tricky part, and here's where the unconscious comes in, because the unconscious is always tricky, tends to create a bit of a conundrum for us when we realize, and this theory is based on observation, not necessarily research, but the theory goes that we also recreate some of the emotional binds that we experienced in our younger years by being drawn to someone who also has some of the negative traits of our caregivers. Now again, this is not conscious. When I work through with couples with this, they'll always say, when we kind of discover this by looking at their backgrounds, and thinking, well, I didn't know this about my partner, before we were married. I didn't, well, of course you didn't. This was an unconscious kind of thing. And this is, gets a little, you have to go with it with the theory a little bit, if it makes sense and if it's helpful. I guess so much of this theory is developed in order to understand and to help us appreciate what our own process is, and there's no corner on which theory is right, except that I think the power of a theory comes out of its usefulness in helping us understand phenomena as we experience it. Yeah,
as someone who does gets involved in counseling stuff for couples that are about ready to split, is this a resource that is effective when they're that far? Or is it something that you need to have some affection and affirmation going on to have that work?
It's a good question. In my experience, if someone isn't quite rooted in a commitment of a relationship to make it better, to really do the hard work, because the list of suggestions he has in here are really a lot of hard work, then it's going to, I think it will tend to falter a bit. And so if a couple is into what I call the ICU of a close relationship, is a pretty critical condition, quite ambivalent, and might need help to work through that ambivalence to a more clarified commitment, then this would be a little bit quicker, I think. So, okay. But for those of us who look for ways of enriching our relationship and understanding the sometimes confusing things that go on, I think it's a useful thing to look at anyway. In my experience, actually, because it is written by men, by a male, I'm very interested in female feedback with it, and I get a variety of feedback. Often the women will say, who read this, well, I've known this a long time, I hope my husband reads it and takes it seriously, because it points a lot to what we call the nurturing, active nurturing behaviors in relationship. And I don't know how it works, but I think there is something to that sense that often in a close relationship, the female or the male can be, but one of the partners may be calling for greater nurture, greater attention, more talking, more time together, that kind of thing. So maybe it is more a book directed towards males who need some education in relationship nurture art. Now, when we talk about soul, that's what I like about keep tying us into our perspective on soul, because soul work, or that is attending to the unconscious dynamics and underlying themes and forces in a relationship, has to do with the unconscious mind, and it's a thing about being open to that. we're talking about, which takes a quietude and a kind of ongoing reflectivity that's very congruent to a spiritual life, to prayerful life, etc. Journaling, for instance, that sort of thing. And yet is not always or not readily applied to marriages. In fact, if we were just to reflect about our own parents' marriages, we may or may not, likely in our culture, come up with a vision of not a lot of time or reflection or soulful time set apart for talking about the relationship, discussing issues, reflecting on issues in a soulful way, as we're talking about. It's kind of timely. And I think, just in terms of our society, I think that it speaks to a what I call an emotional frontier, which has to do with I think as a group we're looking at, you know, how do we do life better? Is the American dream the final answer to all happiness, etc.? And particularly marriage therapists are in a position that says, you know, many of the clients we work with have everything. You know, they have a house and 2.5 kids, etc., 2 cars, and are still wrestling with that central question of relationship vitality. So I think we are, you know, looking at something that that speaks to a, I think, a very inspired, God-directed, wonderful time in our culture of exploring and doing pioneer work, perhaps too, of developing better and better patterns for supporting, sustaining, and keeping vital our close relationships. Which, of course, and somebody asked a couple sessions ago, well, gee, how do we get this across to the young people and whatnot? This stuff, of course, comes through osmosis, an example, not direct sharing, right? So it's the whole business of, you know, how do we do this in our own lives so that we find ways to mirror and reflect vitality in our close relationships. Not just to our young people, by the way, who would then pass that on in their own family creating and whatnot, but I think also generally every vital relationship, I think, exists as a witness to the community, say the church that it exists in, or the neighborhood that it exists in. And from a theological perspective, I think it reflects a kind of valuable way of relating that that does reflect God's relatedness to the world. And in that sense, is like an evangelistic kind of dimension, and certainly a proclamation of good news in itself. But so Harville here, so he says we select it like that. He said that we also select people who demonstrate what he calls the rejected parts or the underdeveloped parts of our own self-image. So if we see ourselves as a go-getter or something like that, and really goal-focused, we might be drawn to somebody who's more B-type or more relaxed, more easygoing. And this will be, again, one of the unconscious parts of the mate selection. Well, it sets up this whole wonderful thing of getting people in trouble by getting married or being in a close relationship. And this is what we start to pick up as part of the mystery and we might say divine impishness or wittiness in this whole thing about close relationships. And it seems to be about getting us in trouble psychologically and spiritually. Or we could say taking us to the growing edge of our own psycho-spiritual development. If in fact, so he's somewhat close in the sense that we were raised in a certain environment, get certain benefits from our family, but then fairly straightforward with, again, either in our close relationships or in a committed relationship, begin to recreate some of those earlier dynamics, then we're right back at working with those issues and going from there. Okay, and so let's. So he says that, you know, that kind of attraction happens. Then there's this drop off that happens fairly predictably, you know, within the first 5 years, usually, sometimes much sooner. And then the illusion of romantic love, he says, slowly erodes. Husband and wives begin to, number one, stir up each other's repressed behaviors and feelings, meaning, you know, the shadow side of the person comes out a little bit. They're not so nice. It's not courtship anymore. It's a much more secure relationship. So behaviors of control, manipulation, all that good stuff starts to come out. They re-injure each other's childhood wounds, is what he suggests, because the way that we are we have been looking for the close relationship to fulfill some of those deeper needs, gets frustrated as much as anything, the limitations of another human being to love us in a way that's a healing love. And three, we project our own negative traits onto one another, which is a tricky thing to see in therapy, for sure. And it's a tricky thing to have my wife point out to me, too. She's usually very, very accurate. But again, the soul perspective says, wow, what am I learning here? What is my wife yelling at me for the 15th time about this thing, teaching me about myself? What do I need to listen to about that? So he's a little bit cynical here, and he says marriage problems can go from bad to worse when partners adopt the strategy of yelling louder or intensifying their attacks or complaints to both express their pain of relationship disillusionment and attempt to get their needs met through coercion rather than negotiation. So if we stay in a soul toxic or soul unfriendly sort of mode that is not respectful, critical, deciding who's right and wrong, all that sort of stuff, then things can go from bad to worse. Pastors start getting phone calls sometimes in the middle of the night. Marital therapy may be negotiated or begun. There could be then, it could get so bad, you know, that there's a sense of, gee, what can we do? We really want to make something better. And he makes a very basic thing about his concept is that this whole business of close relationship operates to some degree on what he calls the old brain or the alligator brain or reptile brain. And I think it'd be a more familiar term, that'd be like a subconscious level. And he says that anytime we relate to somebody or any encounter, even though we know the person closely, our alligator brain will decide several things very quickly and even instantaneously. Whether this is a friend or an enemy, for alligators, someone to eat, someone to ignore, doesn't matter, someone to run away from, which would go with enemy, of course, someone to mate with. So it's just kind of those basic few choices that go on just like that. And if a marriages will get to this point, he says that it's not an if, they will get to some major kinds of disillusionment and frustration. And the challenge then becomes, where do we go from here? And I want to fold that old brain stuff in because it says, how do we work with our unconscious mind so that the positives begin to pile up more and we really re-educate ourselves that we really are each other's friend and not in the enemy side. And that gets back to what we were saying yesterday with some of the research where some of the clearest findings is that a positive overbalance in terms of interaction is very important in close relationships. This 5-to-1 ratio we mentioned yesterday, that is 5 positive kind of interactions to 1 negative, seems to be a real critical ratio for couples. And what that author talks about as the apocalyptic 4 kinds of behavior that we were talking about yesterday is important to remind ourselves of too. He describes those as criticism, defensiveness, contempt, and stonewalling. Those would be the apocalyptic 4. He said if that's very present in the relationship, then things are pretty dire. But
Jim,
yeah, go
ahead. What you were saying earlier that the first person was saying things go from bad to worse when the yelling increases. Now, with stonewalling in that would seem to suggest also that perhaps things go from bad to worse when, if you will, the yelling decreases in terms of now we have silence. So, I mean,
exactly.
How
do yes.
Both of those are the same kind of pattern? Is that
right? And what we said, really, yelling louder is in quotes, which is that helps bring that out very well, because yelling can be any form where somebody says, I'm in distress. And particularly for certain persons, being quiet or not talking for a week or 2 weeks or even a day can say, I'm at an 8.5 on my distress level. Or drinking too much can say that, or praying too much.
So Hendricks would consider, like you say, the weak silent treatment or whatever, that would be part of his yelling.
Louder, right, okay. Yeah. We also, any kind of symptomatic behavior, which is behavior that reveals another process going on. And we all have our favorite symptoms. That is behaviors or patterns that emerge when we're under distress and hurt. So that's, yeah. Okay, let's get to the good news. That's the bad news, all right? That's the bad news. But actually, it's part of the good news, too, because it's part of the human condition. I don't know why God set it up this way, but it's fairly predictable. And the price of close relationships seems to take us through this fire swamp of disillusionment and depression and struggle. And Harville suggested we keep with it. If we keep listening to our desire to build something together of value and of beauty, then we may enter into a pattern of relating that can be characterized in some of these ways. He says, in contrast to the difficulties inherent in the unconscious marriage, that's his term for the old brain marriage or the coming out of our unconscious expectations and unreflected parts, the conscious marriage is characterized by movement towards the following perspectives and relationship patterns. And again, as Michael was helping us a couple days ago, these are not like do this and you'll all be better. These aren't like quick fix sorts of things. They're actually, as you read them, they're actually patterns and processes that are good to review, I think, and to be aware of, and just kind of help check ourselves out with. He says, puzzling aspects, so relationship patterns, number one, would be puzzling aspects of your relationship begin to make sense to you, and you have a greater sense of control. Now, this doesn't happen automatically, but you just step back from maybe the common, fights or that sort of thing. You go, gee, what's going on? Oh, yeah, I'll tell you what, in my marriage, my wife's not here, so I'm free to say more about this. I was second born, she's a first born. Okay, I mean, all this thing with birth order. But this is an important pattern. I mean, because I was very close to my older sister, who was the first born in our family. And there were some issues. One way I got along with my older sister was to go along. I got along with her by going along. And, so I project this evil older sister onto my wife often and have to watch within myself this, sense of being mean controlled and all that. I haven't slipped and called her Barbara, which is my oldest sister's name. I don't do that very often, but that would be a sure sign that I'm, working with not the person who's in front of me. But that's those kind of connections and an ongoing kind of revealing of what the relationship is about, what some of the issues are. And in his sense, when he says greater sense of control, he means a greater sense of not of directing the relationship, but of listening to its nuances and its underlying dynamics in a continuing explorative, wonderful or awful way, in the sense of being awed by its dynamics. And again, the shift, and you'll see, I think, a fundamental shift in all of this in terms of what are we learning from it? Or that is, for ourselves, what is this telling us about our own process? Couple gave me a cartoon recently that very simple, very helpful. It marked a real change in their process. It showed a bookstore here, put a bookstore, and they had these shelves and all these shelves here. And there's all books here. Here, and there was no books here. All books were here, no books here. This was self-help. This was spouse help. And so those are sold out, and all the ideas of what you can do to change the other person were the hot sellers, but the self-help, which of course is what we categorize all of this, a lot of this material as, was still very well stocked. So it's that self-focus, it's very, very important. And I think, again, the soul will signal to us God is like a small voice. If we listen close enough, that's where we start to get an orientation of what's going on with us, with that self-focus following our own process. The second thing he says is you see your partner not as your savior, but as another wounded human being struggling to be healed, or struggling to find a way in the world or moving through. not as a savior, you know, not as an angel or a demon. They go, gee, who'd I marry? And wow, you know, that. But you've got a just another struggling human being. And the shock of this, when we consider that that in initial attractions, we really do have a parental transference, what we call, which means we look at the other person as someone who's going to take care of us in some way. Again, not totally consciously, but there's that child inside who's looking for that good parent. We keep telling ourselves there's no Santa Claus, but we may still be looking for him or her in different ways. But that shift of perspective often takes continued reminding and just, again, ongoing reflectivity about that. Another shift, you accept the need for clear communication. Maybe we hear that all the time, okay? And I would add the need for soulful communication. And here's where we might look at a little deeper level. I mean, we hear clear communication a lot. But this particular book by Thomas More, Soulmates, is really confusing to read. Where this guy, it's not really a stream of consciousness, but it's really a hard outline to pick up, because this guy's a Jungian. He almost speaks sort of directly out of his unconscious. He's always talking about stories and myths and things like that. But I wanted to give you a flavor of what he means by soulful conversation, so you just get a sense of the quality of connecting. Because I've seen couples work very hard at being, you know, clear communicators, and did you understand? Yes, they paraphrase very accurately and whatnot. But to develop and sustain what he calls a soulful conversation is something else. My wife has offered me an image of that for years, and it's just a simple signal. She says, we need to share a cup of tea, is what she says. And that's her image, what she's experienced in close girlfriend relationships. That's when it happens. Then that's when this soul connecting, this heart-to-heart connection happens. And she wants to recreate that with me. With me, it's going to be something different. It won't be a cup of tea, because I don't like tea. But it'll be a space and a way that we find to rhythmically and sufficiently come back to connecting with each other. Thomas More says, true conversation is an interpenetration of worlds, a genuine intercourse of souls, which doesn't have to be self-consciously profound, but does have to touch matters of concern to the soul. The following passage from a letter by Ralph Emerson, dated September 30th, alludes to several elements in soulful conversation. This is Emerson. Hawthorne and I set forth on a walk. Our walk had no incidents. It needed none, for we were both in excellent spirits, had much conversation, for we were both old collectors who had never had opportunity before to show each other our cabinets. And they're on a walk. They weren't showing their collection of bottle caps or anything. They were revealing and sharing their ideas in the cabinet of their soul, the container of their memorable experiences. They are sharing at length about this and that experience, on and on. And these are two men, by the way. This probably makes it pretty amazing. And enjoying that, and that he could relate that in such a clear way. So this has a lot to do with creating space. After a year or more of marital therapy, my wife and I, in our work together, our therapist kept saying, just create some space in your schedule. You know, we talk a lot in marriage about connecting with each other, etc., in our hectic lives and all that. But often there's a specific purpose, you know, to talk about things, that sort of thing. This particular therapist, I really appreciated, because he said, you know, don't plan anything, just set this time apart and see what happens. Which was a very, I think, soulful and insightful kind of intervention, because he knew as a therapist I would probably be real task-oriented and need to get something done or make some insight. But the soul doesn't work that way. It really, I think, is much more interested in finding the opportunity, and will push through, either through symptoms or in some other way, see shouting louder, to get what it needs. But if we give ourselves space without too much directedness, then we're doing something soulful that creates the opportunity for connecting at this level to happen. And again, it's hard to prescribe this, because and often when you set time apart, that's when it won't happen, too. So that's pretty tricky. Of course, this happened during a walk. Walks are a wonderful idea. He also says, a conversation like this does not have to be confessional in order to be soulful. I notice that sometimes people who are just beginning to become more psychologically aware feel compelled to speak whatever is on their mind or in their heart too directly and too innocently. Some people play a game of, I've bared my heart, now you bear yours. But soulfulness is not created by naive exposure. What matters is not how much you expose about yourself in conversation, but that your soul is engaged. Two people working on the plans for a house or immersed in a recipe can be caught up in a soulful conversation. The topic doesn't have to be directly personal. Which that feels paradoxical too, but it's the idea of connecting to a deeper level in each person. He says the soul's favorite modes are reverie or camaraderie, reminiscence, reflection. Those are words that we often in our culture don't spend a lot of time doing. And, you know, if we're going to be in a close relationship, what better place to do that? And we might note that people in a close relationship, if they see that happening, that is that soul connecting happening somewhere else, like a partner's soul being invested in work or in another relationship or in friendship, there's going to be jealousy, there's going to be noticing. Yeah?
One of the things that I notice both in my own relationships as well as people I deal with is that there seems to be X amount of distance between persons. And as one person has a high need for connection and for intimacy and for that kind of soul connection, yeah, and they move forward, you can see the other person backpedaling, yeah, so fast, it's amazing.
Yeah.
How do you, I guess one of the things that I have rarely found that with couples, that both people are at the same need at the same time. How do you get people to take the risk?
Yeah.
Not of going forward, but of just standing still.
Yeah, that's a good observation. I put a plug in for therapy because it's often therapy or some place where there's some help in reflecting about the relationship. I think provides enough containment of that cat and mouse game, we might call it. You know, and. A lot of books have been written about the rubber band man who gets close but then has to bounce back and into his cave and stuff like that. But that really is a rhythm that I think unless couples are helped to apply enough reflection and the person who is needing more attachment or closeness is their feelings are validated enough, usually by, and sometimes it takes another person, or maybe, you know, they talk about it with a friend, doesn't have to be a therapist, but just someplace they get this sense of frustration of, gee, I just can't, you know, I can't connect or I can't capture my mate. If there's enough, then an encouragement, and this, I think, common sense usually says, well, if you tried this, this gives another list, you know, but that's why I think therapy can be a container where the anxiety can go down far enough and the person can be reconnected with the sense that their wholeness isn't related to what this person over here is doing, but that they can be okay, call on their own resources for a while, and that in fact, if it's going like this, and bing, 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 then one person stops, either it's gonna go like this, or it's going like this, and then this person over here is gonna go, yikes, I don't like this much distance, and then begin to move back. And so it's that holding still that you're pointing to, that is a very important skill, and I think a big part of this whole sense of soulful conversation, where we meet together, and not in pursuit or because it's her agenda or his agenda, but because we want to create soulful conversation. And it's that your observation is very widely, you know, seen, and it often I think takes a long time for this transition to occur in a relationship, and often one partner will be there before the other one will, too. But And, you know, there's just so many different ways. We think a lot about verbal, you know, communication, but there's a lot of ways that couples connect at this level. Non-verbally, walks, playfulness. Sometimes a renewed sexuality emerges in a relationship as a sign of reconnecting or of vitality emerging. So we're, particularly as Lutherans, are very word-oriented and think it comes through that way. But your question, it has so many important aspects to it. The whole business of trying to make something happen, for instance, or getting the other person, you know, this way or that way, is a very tricky thing, because generally we're going to get the counter, you know, movement when we try to push with a sovereign, you know, separate individual. So another way to look at it is just keep making ourselves as interesting and, you know, why wouldn't she, want to relate? Okay, you train yourself to behave in a more constructive manner. Sure, that's easy. Train yourself to behave in a more constructive manner. But you get the key word, train yourself to behave, not your spouse. And that's where the, again, that self-focus, which I've been reviewing self-help books for some time, get help with some of the journals I follow, and I tell you, if there's one common theme I hear in the self-help stuff, it's, you know, pay attention to yourself, take care of yourself, fulfill yourself, sometimes, you know, in a way that says, if the relationship, you know, is lost in the dust, okay. But I think with sensitivity to the close relationship, the issue is follow your bliss, yes, also stay connected. And it's that staying connected that I think is often the deeper challenge in some ways. All of us have been, you know, running our own lives for some time, whether we've been single or not, and doing it in a syncopated, connected way is a bit more challenging, certainly more complicated, which is a word Thomas More reminds us means weave together. Complicated means bringing together and woven together, which is a good thing to remember. And it takes more energy, of course. So we focus on ourselves, train ourselves to behave in more constructive ways, and probably the biggest specific skill in that has to do with managing our own reactivity. Okay. Talked the last time about the program installed at the factory. We all have the buttons that get pushed and whatnot. Okay, just a reminder, see, our partner doesn't push our buttons. Okay, they do things and then we push them. We like that boing, you know, they don't reach through and push them. These are our buttons, these are our responses. And I think that's an important thing that keeps, you know, helps keep our focus. Whatever our response is, we get tricked though. Our conscious mind in problem solving says, this happened, I felt this way, therefore this was the problem, my spouse changes and I'll be better. See? Our conscious mind, it's very cause and effect. The soul, the unconscious mind, says, this happened, it reminds me of this over here. See? When my mother looked that way at me, or when my dad was critical, that's what it feels like. And I don't have the response of a peer to a peer. I don't have a response of a friend to someone who has the last week gifted me in 1,000 different ways. I'm not remembering that. My soul is remembering this over here and is looking at and finding an opportunity to get even, or again, that old brain thing, to run or pay back or attack, whatever else. So I think that's one of the fundamental, you know, individual skills in this business, that we train ourselves to understand our own process. You learn to, this is a big one here, very scriptural. You learn to value your partner's needs and wishes as highly as you value your own. Love our neighbor as ourselves. Hearing it for years, easy? No. Natural? It's not natural for me. And here's where I think we see the spiritual dynamic at work, where we see marriage like parenthood, as that relationship in which we're called to give of ourselves, hopefully in some balanced way. I mean, I think that's the way it works, that we receive about as much as we give. But the issue has to be, is focusing on what we're giving and our contribution to the relationship. And this, of course, has to do with a deep awareness of our capacity to give, our neediness, ways we look to close relationships to fill our needs, etc. A great exercise, to give you a practical one here, is exercise 9. I got it memorized. Ask all the couples to do it. It's called the re-romanticizing exercise. My wife and I have done this a couple times. She usually does it first. I forget for several weeks until she reminds me. She reminds me very lovingly to. I'm not sure what it means that you haven't done your list yet. She can get therapeutic on me too. He says it takes 60 minutes. Purpose, by sharing specific information about what pleases you and agreeing to pleasure your partner on a regular, consistent basis, you can turn your relationship into a zone of safety and maintaining that safety. You can do steps 1, 2, 3 separately if you wish. The remaining steps are to be done together. Directions. The first step in this process is to identify what your partner is already doing that pleases you. Get out separate sheets of paper and complete this sentence in as many ways as possible, being specific and positive and focusing on items that happen with some regularity. I feel loved and cared about when you finish that sentence. Fill my coffee cup when it's empty. Let me read the front page of the paper first. Kiss me before you leave the house. Call me from work just to chat. Tell me important things that happened to you. Massage my back. Tell me you love me. Just, he says, it's these ways that we know happen again in the routine of our lives, but it's offering those lists and educating our spouse in those nurturing ways. Now recall the romantic stage of your relationship. Are there any caring behaviors that you used to do for each other that you are no longer doing? Once again, take out separate sheets of paper and complete this sentence. I used to feel loved and cared about when you... I don't want to be resentful about it. You used to do these things. This is another resource of nurturing to plug into. And finally, now think about some of the caring, loving behaviors that you have always wanted but never asked for. Ooh, there's the fun part, right? Then you do that same thing. I would like you to then make a list like that. Then you don't keep your list and score how your partner's doing, on a regular basis. You give the partner the list, and they become the caretakers of your nurturing directives and instructions. Simple idea, but you do this. I've started carrying around my wife's list and try to read it once a day, just to remind myself. Because again, we don't have this in our minds. We will always tend to itch our partner where we itch. it's just how it comes naturally, because we give what we want to receive, expecting that will come through. But again, the soul says no. It's more complicated. Darn it! How do we open ourselves to the mystery of the other person? I don't know why my wife wants me to. I do have it. Which one is this most mysterious to me? Let's see. Oh, this is a great one. I don't know why she asked my opinion about a decision and say a neutral "huh," and come to a mutual decision. I feel loved when you ask my opinion about a decision and say a neutral "huh," and come to a mutual decision. I'll tend to jump right in with my opinion, and I'm practicing. Huh, Chris. Huh. I don't think I've got it down neutral yet. Right. But that's the kind of direction that really works. We're in the playful stage with that one now. And she'll catch me. She'll say, "Oh, this is a huh, honey." So we're training ourselves. We work strong. We learn to value our partner's needs. Embrace the dark side of our personality. If that's not Jungian, I don't know what is. There is this embracing that in close relationships, we've got this alligator old brain self that wants to get even, that wants to pay back. We all know that side of close relationships. We should talk about it more in church. I mean, where else, except in the context of grace, would it be safer to talk about it? But it's all there. We hurt the ones we love verbally and get confused with that. But it's that business of again appreciating that that's part of it and learning from that. certainly not tolerating, you know, destructive or violent behavior in any way, but when it's an atmosphere of soulful reflection, it becomes, you know, okay, what's going on with me? What's my dark side about? What am I trying to resolve with this? Because remember, this is my understanding of anger anyway. Anger, sometimes sadness or depression, is a secondary emotion, usually fed by some sort of hurt, frustration, or those are the main ones, disappointment,
loss.
What about anxiety?
Anxiety, I would put up here is secondary for the reason that anxiety is such a wonderful signal emotion that it could have, it usually has some other aspect to it. And that's where anger would be also a signal emotion. So it's worth a soulful reflection on, to what am I anxious about? It is so diffused in such a powerful sense. So the shadow side is going to either passively get even, or you know, if it's open, then you know it's maybe even a little easier to grab a hold of. But it's knowing that side of us and working with that. Again, not in a shame blame sort of way, but in a discovering and of course relating to our partner shadow as something that belongs to them and we can give feedback to, but aren't responsible for. Learn new techniques to satisfy your basic needs and desires. That just basically means not putting the partner in that savior position. Search within yourself, there it is again, for the strengths and abilities you lack. Here's this thing, you pick this partner who's different, who has all these traits, don't get it by osmosis. It's this self-development program. Marriage is self-development thing. You become more aware of your drive to be loving and whole and united with the universe. There's where he's really picking into the soul dimension, where if soul, as we've been saying, has something to do with the life force that is related to everything else in the universe, and then if we're related to something and are in fact interrelated, interconnected, and interdependent, why would we mess up something like rivers or water or air or earth that we're directly connected with and directly dependent on for our well-being? This is the point too, is that's a soul dimension, is that relatedness and that connectedness that inspires us to overcome the instinctual quick gain or quick fix or quick release kind of behavior. Okay, and the final one, he says, you accept the difficulty of creating a good marriage. Well, I sure hope so. right, so we, you know, but the old model is what? You know, live happily ever after, make the right choice, and it'll unfold naturally. Don't read Harville, if he'll shake that up. And don't talk to people who are married more than 5 years, though. It's a different story. Well, that's some of the stirrings in this direction, and some of the suggestions for the vitality stuff. I really do recommend it because he's really good at going beyond, you know, checklists and that sort of thing. He talks, for instance, about play, the importance of play, wit, and humor. And we've all experienced, I certainly hope, in close relationships where we had the 10th, you know, we fought about this thing for the 10,000th time, and somebody just breaks out laughing. Oh man, how many times are we going to do this? Or brings a certain humorous perspective around a situation. He talks, besides conversation, he suggests writing as a real good resource also. Marriage Encounter, how many people have ever done Marriage Encounter, think that? Yeah. Yeah, the old writing exercise. You know, but Thomas is Moore does an interesting thing. This guy isn't resurrected from the dead, by the way. He's just I don't think he's related to the Thomas Moore Englishman. But he talks about writing in a very soulful way, where he says to write it takes more time. We're more reflective, and we really are presenting a different part of ourselves to our partner. and communicating really a lot in terms of effort and time and consideration in that particular thing. So, you know, it's not a bad practice. I think after fight, you write down our ideas, write a letter, re-express commitments and concerns. So writing is, but what, it takes more time. And that's why I think one of the tensions in all of this ties back to our soul pushing for lifestyle changes. And here's, I think, where our discussion ties into a lot of what we discuss here at Holden. And that is that our solidarity with the God who works for justice and equal relationships and functional democracy and that sort of stuff calls for often difficult lifestyle sort of things, and lifestyles that are often very contrary or go against the stream of go fast, do more, get more, one with the most toys wins, that sort of stuff. And again, when we see our close relationships as a place where we're working on that, I think that's, to me, that's, of course, that's where my passion is and my excitement. Where I see couples making those shifts is very exciting. I just need to bring as much passion to my own marriage, but well, you see how that ties in. Okay, any questions, comments there? It's a lot, but
the only thing is, I have this image that I keep in my mind when I think of some of these things, and it's, you talk about the rhythm, and the image I get in my mind is dancing. And everybody has their own dance that they do. Yes. And you do maybe practice on your part, and another person practices on their part, and you bring it together, and you work on it together. And in the end, it can be very frustrating to step on each other's toes, but in the end, there's a beautiful dance. And it's, you know, it's the rhythm, and it goes back and forth. And there's, I love that image of it. When I think of certain things, I can just think of that as an image.
Very helpful. Yes, the artfulness of it. We do an exercise with couples sometimes of having them walk together down a hall, just to see how they walk. Who's ahead? Who's behind? Are they bumping hips? You know, have to really work that out, you know, to some degree, or play a game in the office. My son and daughter have these little propeller sticks where you go like this and things takes off and you can't actually play catch with it. I'm going to bring that to the office, see how couples do with that. But that's one way of getting at that coordinated, and it's getting that soulful level, that the rhythms and connectedness, which takes a lot of consideration. And really is what, I mean, and that metaphor is such a beautiful one, because, and I think it reflects that value we've talked about before, the soulful value of moving towards the beautiful, which would be related life in some kind of syncopation, which, is that the right word? Coordinated rhythms. Yeah, that's a good one. Okay, let's see. We've got something. I'll be off tomorrow and off to Holden Lake. Anyone else going to Holden Lake tomorrow? I'll be up there. I'll try to be there before the sun comes up. Yeah, okay. Good. Yeah, that's...
We went up today.
Oh, okay. Yeah, the bug's pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All depends when you leave. When we left, they were really bad. It's better. We left at about 8:30.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That was too late, okay.
But on the way back, it was fine. It wasn't bad at all.
Okay, good. Yeah. They even slow down in the heat. Saturday, we'll offer something again and tie some of this together in terms of spiritual wholeness, have another aspect to share with you, another author. So thanks for your attention. Thanks for coming out. Hot night. Wow.